Hello, you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is Little Atoms with Richard Sanderson and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show which is pro-science, rationalism, humanism and the progressive left. On each show we talk to a guest from the world of science, politics and journalism about subjects as diverse as conspiracy theories, cosmology, religion, the New Age, human rights and the state of the left. Our guest on tonight's show is the Marxist philosopher and Emeritus Professor at the University of Manchester, Norman Guerras. So we're going to hear some more of the theme tune, and then Richard will come in and introduce Norman. I hope you enjoy the show.
Oh, well, remember us. It's Little Atoms, and we're actually finally got all the mics plugged in. Norm is here, who arrived before us in his eagerness to appear on the show. Let me just introduce him. Norman Guerras is a former professor in the Department of Government at the University of Manchester, or rather a visiting emeritus professor, I believe is the situation now. He's the author of several books, including Marx and Human Nature and The Contract of Mutual Indifference, Political Philosophy After the Holocaust. But since 2003, he's become a persistent and welcome presence on the internet with his weblog Normblog, which in turn has led to him being described as a cutting-edge cyber phenomenon, albeit in inverted commas in The Guardian, and a member of the New Commentariat, which has a lovely ring to it. His website is updated several times a day, and despite its reputation as a heavyweight political commentary, there's also regular features on the arts and two of Norm's other obsessions, cricket and, amongst other things, the music of Bob Dylan. And Norm, I'm wondering, now that you've been doing this website for probably over 2 years, and you do post 3 or 4 times a day, if not more than that, I'm wondering whether you now feel that it's a sort of compulsion to do it. Do you really miss it if you find you're away from the computer and unable to post?
It's not so much that I miss it as that I feel a sort of pressure to post things, and I probably feel it more than necessary, but I definitely do have that kind of blogger addiction, blogger obsession, and it's a combination of different things. Partly you feel, well, people will be coming to the site and looking for something to read, and if there's nothing new, you know, you're somehow letting yourself down.
Well, it's very true. I mean, there are some websites and weblogs. I mean, the golden rule of a weblog is to update it regularly. There's nothing more disappointing than going to some weblog that you like and it's still the same post that's been there for the last 4 days. I suppose what I was particularly curious about is, it's the inevitable question of why did you start it? And in what circumstances?
Okay, well, I started in July 2003, and I was kind of knocked out from doing any serious work at the time, because I'd just been undergoing some medical treatment, so I was feeling, you know, a bit ropey, and so I thought, well, while I'm kind of getting through that, let me just have a go at this. And essentially it was two things. One was, I'd been reading blogs for a few months, I can't remember exactly how long, and it just aroused my interest, my curiosity, and I thought, well, I'd like to have a go at this and just see how it turns out. And it was just a kind of experiment, but the primary reason was a political one, which was, you know, that was shortly after the Iraq war, and you know, there'd been a lot of discussion in the press and on the internet, and I kind of felt that the point of view that I and some others on the left represented wasn't getting enough coverage in the mainstream media. So I thought, well, I'd like to have my say, basically.
When you say you were reading a few other blogs, can you remember which ones they were and whether they're still around?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are still around. In the natural course of events, some blogs just die, and I understand very well why they do. Because
recently, Harry, who was a guest on this program, sort of hung up his keyboard for a bit. Although I noticed he posted something like 5 times today, so obviously he can't keep away.
Yeah, but I mean, there is a wastage rate, and that's understandable because it's hard to maintain a blog. So, yeah, I mean, I was reading. Well, Harry's Place was one of the early ones that I read, and I was reading some of the North American blogs, and I mean because it's been a kind of organic process, reading and finding new ones and so forth, I couldn't tell you exactly all the blogs I was reading at that time. I remember a few of them.
Yeah.
Do you think you have although obviously it's the same subject matter, do you think you have a different audience to Harry's Place?
I find it very hard to say. I mean, I think Harry's Place have a bigger readership than I do. Well, I know they do. I think there must be a very large overlap. But it's likely that there are, you know, some of my readers who don't read Harry and vice versa. I mean, just I expect that's the case.
Do you know how big your audience is?
Well, I know what my sort of average daily hits are. I don't know what that means in terms of the absolute size of the audience, because, you know, some people might be coming more than once
more
a day,
once,
and
yeah,
others might be coming. But you know, you get a sense. You get a sense. I mean, I get email from all over the world, so you know, it's quite a widely spread readership.
So, were you surprised at the sort of extent of the response to the blog?
Well, in the first week, I wasn't surprised. I was astonished, because what happened was I started thinking, well, I'll try this, and you know, I'll tell my family and my friends, and I imagined that, you know, I would cruise along at the beginning with, you know, maybe try and get up to 100 readers and so forth. But I don't quite know how this happens, that people just find out about things. On the second day of blogging, I put up a long post on the Iraq War, which was a sort of version of a talk I'd given in London. I don't recall how much earlier, but a couple of months earlier, perhaps. And somehow that it just got round that was there, and I was linked by several blogs to that post, including a couple of the big American blogs. Andrew Sullivan linked to it, and Instapundit linked to it. So on the third and fourth days, I already had a few thousand people coming there.
Uh-huh. That's extraordinary quick growth then, because you normally think of a blog as being something that builds, you know, sort of accretes readers at a pretty slow rate. So that was, you're obviously getting the links must have.
Well, I mean, that was a big spike at the beginning. Of course, it didn't stay like that. But it immediately settled into a few hundred a day.
Right. Oh, that's
and,
great.
It's kind of grown steadily from that. So, yeah, no, I never imagined that I'd have that many readers as quickly as I did.
Well, you mentioned that you started the blog because there wasn't that many people representing the position. And so presumably there were also people out there that were looking to read something that was representing the position you do as well. Although I presume you also get a lot of readership. I mean, you say you get a lot of emails. Do you get emails from people, the sort of masochists who come in and read you every day but don't agree with it and then sort of send?
Yeah, of course, I do get emails from people who are critical, you know, of the views I argue, and a few hostile. Though, actually, to my surprise, I get very little email like that, you know, out and out hostile or abusive. But the majority of the email I get is is friendly. I mean, friendly either in the sense of agreeing, or friendly in the sense of, even though having differences, engaging in a civil way, which is fine. I mean, that's you know, that's what it's all about.
One of the things that you mentioned just then was as one of the reasons why you do blog, or why you started, was that you felt that there was a kind of unheard voice and an opinion, if you like, a pro-war left voice. Although I'm not, neither Neil or I particularly happy with the term pro-war. I mean, it sounds. It sounds unnecessarily...
Well, nobody's pro-war, are they? War's a nasty thing, but pro-interventionist,
it's a
pro-regime change or something.
Or sometimes, I mean, the Harry's Place guys and me and a lot of the other sort of, if you want to, sort of liberal hawk blogs, you know, there are a lot of other ones. I mean, you know, Pooja Geek and Hack Mao and Eric the Unread and the drink-soaked Trotskyite, Pop and Jays and a general theory of rubbish. You know, there are a lot of... So sometimes just to get up the noses of the opposition, we'll talk about ourselves as the pro-liberation left.
Mm-hmm. And, but it is interesting, you've now mentioned you've reeled off a list of about 8 different blogs that have, you know, there are definite points where they cross over in viewpoint, and I'm wondering whether it is quite interesting that it's the blogosphere, if you like, which has brought these groups together, and whether we would have known about these views to such an extent if it was just reflected in the print media.
Well, if it was properly represented in the left liberal press, as it should have been, then I don't know, maybe it would have been different in the blogosphere. Who's to say? But, you know, that's one of the sort of minor scandals of the contemporary, you know, political life of the West, that this viewpoint isn't being adequately represented. You look at the comments pages of The Guardian, it would be false to say that it never gets a look in there, but if you look...
Indeed, because you actually had an article printed in there yourself.
I had a piece there, and occasionally, you know, I can't remember all the instances, but I think William Shawcross has occasionally popped up there, but the balance of it is so overwhelmingly the other way, and... you know, that's a crying shame, quite frankly. The Guardian is the paper, the newspaper of British left liberalism, and you know, this has been a major debate. It should have reflected that better than it has.
So we spoke to Harry from Harry's Place about this, and to David Imanovich, and it is obviously a major theme of our show. But I'd like to get your take on this, the sort of split that happened between the sort of left wing ideologies, and how, you know, you're obviously on. Well, we were just talking about descriptive terms for the position, and another one I like, although it is it was pejorative, I'm sure, but I like the idea that the decent left is a term that's sort of in currency on some of the blogs. But well, what's your take on this split in the sort of ideologies of the left?
Okay, well, I'll just say first of all that the term decent left is not one I've ever claimed or used, and though it was introduced by someone for whom I have immense admiration, and he introduced it in a way that made perfect sense, I wouldn't use it myself as a regular thing because of what it implies. It implies that the other part of the left is indecent, which is not the case. I mean, you know, they have a different view, and some of them have a view which is, you know, which I regard as appalling, and others have a view with which I disagree, but I think it's an honest and sincere difference that's inevitable over a big issue. But I wouldn't use that term, and I've never claimed it. There's a section of the sort of blogging left that talks about the decent left in scare quotes, and they use it in a sneering way.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
But I don't know. As to the question overall, I don't know, can you kind of sort of focus it a bit more? Because, you know, what's my take on it?
I think it's just
a big question.
I suppose we're asking whether you... there's a Nick Cohen, for example, is talking about an almost unbreachable chasm that's appearing between in the left at the moment, and considers that at some point everybody has to jump onto sides. It seems to me an extraordinarily dramatic way of thinking about it. And I'm wondering whether you agree with Nick on that, or whether you think it is repairable, it is bridgeable, this gap. Because if it is a chasm, as Nick seems to see it as, then that is a very serious crisis in the left.
Yeah. Well, I would say yes and no. There's a chasm in one sense. If you take... there's been a certain way of opposing the war where, you know, well-known voices on the left who've actually supported the so-called Iraqi resistance, making kind of evasive noises about, you know, murder of civilians and this kind of thing. There is a kind of section of the far left where, you know, I don't sort of read them out of the left as some others on the left do, because I don't do that. I mean, unfortunately, it's a truth about the left that it has some extremely unhealthy currents within it. But in any case, there is that kind of section where, yeah, it is a chasm, and I don't regret the fact that it's unbridgeable. I've said this on my blog once. I don't want to be united with people like that. The left has lost too much. It has cost the left too much historically. Making apology for regimes and practices and movements, which should not have been excused. They should have been criticized.
Yeah.
So I have no desire to be united with that kind of view. But, you know, with every political division of this sort, there are always in-between positions. And it seems to me that to say that there's no possibility of unity between pro- and anti-war currents on other matters in the future, I mean, that's just too pessimistic. Why not?
That's what I would have thought, that it was a pessimistic view. And I mean, even within, you know, if we talk about the Labour Party still being a left organisation, then that's a party which is managing to, you know, to keep together its... there's an awful lot of members of the Labour Party who were virulently opposed to the war, and yet are still... haven't felt the great desire to go rushing off and joining George Galloway's Respect Party or anything like that. So maybe there is some indications there.
And I mean, there are shades and shades. There are people who opposed the war, and, you know, they opposed it vigorously and conscientiously. But once the war happened, they've been quite emphatic about where they stood in regard to what they want to see happen.
Mm-hmm.
They support the democratic forces in Iraq, and there's already common initiatives between people like me, Harry, and so forth, who supported the war, others who opposed the war, but have been sort of staunchly behind, supporting the kind of democratic initiatives in Iraq.
And not cutting and running as soon as we can.
And then if you go a bit further over, I mean, you know, to be honest, most of the people I know in my friendships and my professional life and so forth were people who opposed the war. And we've had vigorous arguments, sometimes very vigorous arguments.
It's the dinner party problem, isn't it, when the war subject comes up?
Yeah, but they don't anathematize me, and I don't anathematize them. In fact, you know, surely the left should have grown up by now to this, that you know, you have to disagree sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what a healthy left does. Now, of course, within the debate, there is also a lot of kind of excommunication going on. People saying, well, you know, you you know, I've had a fair bit of that since I started my blog. I mean, on day one or two, somebody wrote to me that I was an imperialist skunk, which, you know, I think is terrific, actually. But
well, yeah, I'd be interesting to know, Norm. I'm sure you've repeated this many times on the blog and to other people, so I apologise for that. But could you share with our listeners the point where it was crystallised for yourself, exactly where you stood which side of the chasm you stood?
Yeah, it's September 11, 2001. I mean, there's a prehistory to this in that I supported the first Gulf War, and you know, the Kosovo, the Kosovo intervention, and so on. But through the 90s, I kind of felt uncomfortable. You know, it seems to me clear that these are the positions that somebody who's opposed to kind of dictatorship and genocide and so forth, you know, these are the positions one has to take. But I don't know, a lot of my comrades and friends there on the other side, and I kind of felt, well, you know, I kept going through it in my mind, well, you know, am I going wrong somewhere here? And thinking, well, no. But anyway, I just kind of lived with that kind of discomfort. September 11, 2001, I mean, I just, I was in the department in my office, and a friend of mine called me into his office saying, have you heard what's happening? And I went and listened on his radio, and we heard this. And I mean, it struck me within minutes, really, that this kind of changes things. Not that, you know, there hasn't been terrorism before, but on this scale, a kind of willingness to murder people in their thousands, and of course we didn't know at that time, is it 3,000, you know, it could have been 10, 20. And, like everybody else, I was just appalled. And I kind of thought, well, how long is it before the kind of voices of apologia and excuse making? And the answer was no time at all. Open the newspaper the next day, and there it all is. You know, well, yes, but what Christopher Hitchens calls the kind of throat clearing moment. Now, some people have short memories, and you'll find discussion on some blogs as to, well, was there really any of that kind of stuff? There really was. I have a pile of press cuttings about this high, and you can tell your listeners.
Norm is raising his arm to shoulder height.
You know, just from the weeks that followed, the lamentable kind of stuff. Now, of course, you don't even have to go back, because every time something like that happens, it's immediately there, and in a way, it's worse each time, because you'd think, well, people would have learned from the last time to be a bit more circumspect in what they say. But anyway, the days after September the 11th were just it for me. I just thought, no, I'm not part of any current on the left that speaks like this. And I'm no longer just going to amble around talking to myself and my immediate circle about this. I'm going to try and put my voice in the public domain, and that really is the impulse, one of the main impulses behind my blog.
I think we're going to take a very short break now, and it's going to be a slight sort of lurch of mood from the for a moment. Well, I think we've got the right track queued up. Jamie's going to set a track going for us. It's actually Bob Dylan, and I know, Norm, that you're a fan, and so am I. Yeah. So I did ask you to choose a track, and you chose I and I from the album Infidels from 1983, I think it is. In a nutshell, what is it about this track in particular that made you choose it over perhaps, you know, people might have expected one of the sort of classic 60s tracks?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that. I mean, on a basic level, it's like with any song that you love, it just grabs me somehow.
The
kind of melody and the and the lyric. But it's always intrigued me, and I did blog about it once, though I've forgotten exactly what I said, but I got some quite interesting feedback. You know, just what is the song saying? And as always with Dylan, you kind of feel, you can intuit a certain amount of what it might be saying, but, you know, everybody's going to take their own sense from it.
And it is from the album Infidels, which wouldn't be a better title for an album for a programme like this. Let's hear it. Okay, that was Bob Dylan from the album Infidels. It was the choice of our guest on Little Atoms, Norman Gerus. And that was with Sly and Robbie on bass and drums, Mick Taylor, I think, from the Stones on guitar, and the inimitable Mark Knopfler, not heard very often on Resonance on guitar there. But let's remember, Mark Knopfler also played on Scott Walker's Climate of Hunter, so he does have some avant-garde credentials as well. Okay, after that little break, Norma, and thanks for bringing that in for us, I want to get back to the subject of apologists, which I think has been crux of some of your most important writing recently. And there was the article you wrote for The Guardian, which in some circles was notorious. I think it got some quite furious responses afterwards. And it was an article that you wrote called "There Are Apologists Amongst Us," and this was after the London bombings on the 7th of July. Can you tell us roughly the crux of what you were saying in that article, and why you felt compelled to write it?
Well, it was the same thing as after September the 11th, that in the days after July 7th, there was what I myself construed as a certain amount of apologetic writing, including in The Guardian. So I wrote a long post about this, and shortly afterwards I was approached by Seamus Mill of The Guardian and asking me, you know, did I want to do something for them? And I said, well, I could abridge this. So that piece is actually abridged from a longer argument. And I got a lot of email feedback, you know, from people who evidently hadn't previously been reading my blog and read The Guardian piece. And that was sort of 50-50 agreeing and disagreeing, slightly more disagreeing. And a lot of that disagreeing email, when it wasn't just out and out sort of, you know, how can a professor say such preposterous things? And one gentleman wrote to me that he was glad that his son wasn't, after all, coming to Manchester, because if there were people like me teaching there, etc. But the ones that were sort of more substantive, a lot of them made the point which I myself had made in that article, which is, of course, there's nothing wrong with trying to understand the causes of something. And I've been endlessly told this as if I might somehow not know it, which is, it's just unlikely, given that, you know, I work in a politics department and I've spent half my life, you know, reading articles and books in sort of social science and social theory. But yes, it's important to understand, but there is a certain amount of writing which goes beyond understanding in the genuine sense and makes excuses. Mm. Now, I mean, I'll let you in there, but I've got more I could say about this if you want me to.
Yeah, I was just curious, because there was, I mean, shortly after, I think it was the poet and children's writer Michael Rosen wrote a poem, and I forget it how it went completely, but to paraphrase, it was very much sort of, if you bomb people, they will bomb you. What would your argument be against that? I mean, he was sort of basically saying, well, you know, we bombed Iraq, so they're obviously going to come along and bomb us. Well, what would your argument be against that viewpoint, which, you know, a lot of people would hold?
Well, the bombing of civilians, whoever does it, is wrong. It's against the laws of war. So it is right that insofar as governments at war, you know, that includes the US and British governments, insofar as they wantonly and deliberately bomb civilians, then they are at fault. Mm-hmm. But I remember the Mike Rosen poem you're talking about. I mean, I remember the occasion of it, and I commented on it critically, though I don't remember precisely the content of it now. But But the argument, if they do this, that doesn't stand up, and I doubt whether Mike Rosen or anybody else of that view would be willing to accept it if you turned it round. Mm-hmm. I mean, if in response to July the 7th, the bombers had been sent out just to bomb some civilians somewhere, would they have said, well, that's okay if we've been bombed, so we can bomb in return? No. It's a crime, whoever does it. I mean, that's just it.
It really is as simple as that. Sorry, I thought you had a point you were all going to make, Neil.
If I can sort of link something else to that, which is, it's the idea of anti-Americanism. There's obviously an idea that, you know, the American hegemony is a bad thing, and it seems to be that a lot of the opponents of the Iraq War and the intervention in Afghanistan as well has been about the idea that, you know, whatever America does is wrong, therefore, you know, whoever they do it to, we're on the side of. And obviously then, you know, they get themselves into quite a hole when there's bombs in London, because you're in a position where you have to defend that happening. I mean, it's unequivocal, really. You've supported that action in the first place. So, you know, what do you think of that position? I mean, do you think there's anything more to it than just pure anti-Americanism?
Sorry, you mean you have to defend what? Defend the bombing?
Well, I mean, if you put yourself in a position where you say, you know, like, for instance, sort of Michael Moore saying that the Iraqi insurgents are the equivalent of the Minutemen and whatever. If you put yourself in that position, if that's where you're standing, then when something like the bombings happen, you're not really in the position to disavow them, really.
Well, look, I wouldn't want to overstate this. The number of people who either actively endorse stuff like the London bombings or make excuses and is not a huge number of people. You know, I would say, you know, on the liberal left broadly conceived, that's a minority of people. But it happens, and that I just, before trying to answer your latest question, I just want to say one more word about this. People who deny that this goes on are guilty of a double failure. One is, they never engage over the specific cases. I mean, when I said there's been apologetic writing, including in The Guardian, I actually went through and said this, and I itemized. I exemplified what I was talking about. Nobody who wrote to me in sort of outrage or dismay about this. None of them engaged and said, well, actually, you've read this wrongly. They just said, no, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if that's the level of argument, I can also do and say, well, yes, it does. But the other thing is, it shows a complete lack of historical sense. You look at any sort of movement or phenomenon or regime of a politically unpleasant sort, there are always gradations. There are the let's take, because it's always the example, Nazi Europe. Yeah, there were the Nazis, the SS. Was that it? Nazis and victims? Of course not. There were collaborators, sympathizers, apologists, you know, a furthering out, people who weren't actively involved but were silent, either because they were afraid or they didn't care, indifferent, etc. And then it shades over to those who are on the receiving end. The idea that something of the nature of what's happening today, you know, a worldwide movement of people who are putting bombs on trains and buses and so on and so forth, that this could happen and it just be a black and white thing, you know, they are the perpetrators and then everybody else is sort of the good guys. It isn't like that. There are people who make excuses, and you can document that. But then there are others who make excuses for the people who make excuses. They say, well, no, they're only just explaining. Mm-hmm. but they aren't only just explaining. Some are and some aren't. It's a matter of specific cases. And to judge which is which, you have to look at the balance of what's said, how it's said. Sorry, if I can just say a third thing. Everyone knows from daily life the difference between an explanation and a feeble excuse. We're all familiar with that. You know, somebody does something very unpleasant in personal life. His or her friend may try and explain it, put it in context in a way that genuinely helps you to understand. And another, because they don't much care or for whatever reason, they'll make a feeble excuse. We all know how to recognize it. So the idea that this doesn't happen with a major sort of political phenomenon like this, it's just implausible. So sorry, then the question was, I think a lot of what goes on the left in relation to, you know, the intervention in Afghanistan, the Iraq war, terrorism and so forth, a certain amount of that has got to do with anti-Americanism. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of knee-jerk thing that, you know, American foreign policy has been wrong since the year dot. You know, it's been supporting repressive regimes and opposing progressive movements, and people just think, well, you know, that's it. They've settled into that position. That's what they must be up to. But in Afghanistan, they were responding to an attack on New York and Washington, and they took out the Taliban. If the people who opposed that war had prevailed, the Taliban would still be in place in Afghanistan. I mean, you know, as I said in the talk I gave, the one I alluded to before, which I posted on my blog, I'm not putting one foot in front of another, not one foot, to try and ensure that the Taliban remains in power or Saddam Hussein. I mean, I didn't spend my life reading kind of socialist theory and educating myself in sort of progressive thought to make myself an instrument of the survival of regimes like that. Another thing I'd like to say about this is, and I've put this question 100 times, okay, no, that's an exaggeration, but 20 times. The people who felt they couldn't support the war because, you know, quite reasonably some of them, they thought, look, on balance it won't work out.
A lot of people were also, you know, the UN thing was obviously very important to people that there wasn't.
But why did they... There was a third way. You know, if American imperialism is something you feel you can't support, and that's how you view the world, you don't have to then act in such a way as to ensure the survival of a sort of semi-fascist regime. There's a third position, neither Washington nor Baghdad. I've never heard an explanation for why that position wasn't adopted. They didn't have to march to save Saddam. Now, of course, they weren't. That's not what they were marching for.
They would vehemently deny that, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that that's how they saw their marching. It wouldn't be a fair way of putting it. I just use it as a shorthand. The effect of opposing the intervention would have been to preserve that regime.
Well, and preserve the sanctions, which a lot of people were extremely unhappy about for very good reasons.
Well, it's interesting that you described it as, you know, you've been a socialist, a Marxist for you know many years, and you would not put one foot in front of another in the defence of a repressive totalitarian regime. But it does seem like, getting back to this split on the left, that there are a lot of people on the left who that has not been an issue for at all, and have quite easily jumped into bed with fascists, to put a
I have to say, you know, one learns all along in one's life, and I suppose that's a good thing. But that has been a genuine shock to me, a genuine shock, because at least my generation of the left, I thought that, you know, we, most of us, we're kind of, we grew up in a kind of left-wing culture which understood the horrors of Stalinism and which knew all about the kind of fellow travelling and the apologia and so on and so forth. To see sections of that left, including, you know, that came out of Trotskyism, making common cause with the forces that they shouldn't be, I mean, that has been a shock to me. But not as much of a shock as the much larger segment of sort of nearer left opinion, which is sort of somehow in between.
Yes.
In between.
Well, when you described a third way a while ago, I mean, what has shocked me is that there hasn't been, there's not a vocal voice of the left saying we're against the war, but we are for the Democrats and the secularists that are in Iraq that are being oppressed by the Baathists, and you know, I never heard that voice.
Well, there is a small segment of what I would call, you know, the pro-liberation left. People who oppose the war but are precisely on that, and quite clear and vociferously, we are for. But for some reason, for too many people who oppose the war, they can't get it out of their mouth. They can't say it. Anything that goes wrong in the war, they can say, you see Bush, Blair, you see, it's all gone wrong like we said. When there's an election and thousands, millions of Iraqis go out to vote, it sticks in their throat.
It's uncomfortable for a lot of people.
It sticks in their throat.
It's an odd thing, you know. If we are democratic socialists, then we surely should be applauding the sights of people queuing to vote.
I just think it's some sort of, you have to give it some sort of psychological explanation, that it's not that they're actually against that happening, but it's troublesome for people who oppose the war to say, well, okay, well, we oppose the war, but you who supported it, okay, this has come about through the war. It's good. It sticks in their throats. So it's not that they want everything to go badly, but somehow, yeah, they can't celebrate when it goes well. And some of the anti-war blogs, it's quite entertaining just to see on those days. I mean, on days when things are going badly, they're pointing it out to all of us, as if we can't see it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're only too well aware. Yeah.
But on days when something goes well, a silence descends. You know, they can't. They just can't celebrate. You know, or they get it out between gritted teeth.
I think that's about all we've got time for. So, thank you very much, Norman, for taking the time to.
Yes, thanks very much, Norman.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sadly, we haven't really been able to explore some of the other things you talk about on your blog. We've given the impression that your blog is some sort of extremely heavy political read. And of course it isn't. It's an extremely friendly and always changing. I go 4 or 5 times a day, and there seems to be a new post on it all the time. There's posts about cricket, there's posts about art, you've had votes about poetry, you have regular interviews and surveys with other writers and guest writers as well. So it really is a marvellous read. So I think if you just put Norm blog into Google, it'll take you there. But
can I just mention our website as well, which is www.littleatoms.com, where you can download some of our previous interviews and this one as well, eventually, when we get it sorted.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and we'll be celebrating 150 years of New Humanist magazine. Norm, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.